This podcast is offered by Jikoji Zen Center on the web at jikoji.org. Our programs are made possible by donations from people like you.
Unsurpassed, penetrating, and perfect Dharma is rarely met with, even in 100,000 million kalpas, having it to see and listen to remember and accept. I vow to taste the truth of the Tathagata's words.
Good morning. We often start with just very quickly introducing ourselves, just saying our names so we all know who's here. I think even with this larger group, it might be worth just going around the Zendo once and just say your name. So I'm Dan.
I'm Craig.
Holly.
Mike.
Ben.
Hogan.
Nick.
Tom.
Randy.
Greg.
Michael.
Emilio.
David.
Simon. Karen.
Ross.
Nico.
Kanako.
Dan.
David.
Alex.
Carolyn.
Mark.
Jean.
Nestor.
Violet.
Andy.
Thank you. Welcome. So today I thought I would talk a little bit about mindfulness and meditation and Buddhism. In formal settings, we often talk as if those three are all the same. Mindfulness and meditation and the Buddha Dharma. But they aren't, and they're related. So I thought I'd talk a little about how the three intersect. Most of you probably know the broad outlines of Buddha's life story. There turns out to be a bit of controversy about exactly when Buddha lived. Because no one tried to pin down the date until much later. And the original stories that we have don't really mention any current events that we could use to cross-check and date them. And so actually scholars from different Buddhist countries have different dates, and these differ by about 100 years. But most agree that he lived around 500 BC. Regardless of precisely when, everyone agrees that Buddha was born an Indian prince, that he led a highly sheltered life in a beautiful palace, but that then, around the time of his 29th birthday, he ran away to become a wandering ascetic. He then spent 6 years crisscrossing the Indian countryside, practicing all sorts of austerities under various notable teachers of his day. And then he got fed up with that life too, convinced that it wasn't bringing him the answers to life's big questions. So at last he decided to just sit by himself and meditate. And that's when he had his big epiphany, his awakening, when he earned the title of Buddha. And actually, Buddha's first inclination was to stop there. He had done it. He had accomplished this goal after all those years of effort. He was enlightened, and he could finally stop searching. But in the end, he decided to teach and started gathering followers. And these followers memorized and eventually wrote down his teachings, which then formed the basis of Buddhism. These writings are usually called the sutras in English, after the Sanskrit word for them. And the oldest collection is probably the one written in Pali, another of the ancient languages of India. Buddha probably didn't speak Pali himself, but that seems to be the language in which his words were first written down, or at least the oldest version we have. We don't tend to focus on the Pali Sutras in Zen Buddhism much, the branch of Buddhism we practice here. I think for a few reasons. First, Zen grew out of a later Buddhist movement called the Mahayana, which added a great number of sutras to those original Pali ones. To be fair, the early Mahayanists wouldn't describe it that way. They would say they discovered more of Buddha's original sutras, which had been hidden by the gods for several centuries until people were ready to hear them again. But regardless of when or how they were written, in Zen we tend to focus much more on those later sutras, like the Heart Sutra that we chanted in the service this morning. Most of those original Pali sutras are incorporated in the Mahayana sutras one way or another, but there are so many additional ones that the Pali original ones tend to get a little lost. And the full set of Mahayana sutras hasn't even been translated into English yet, another reason why maybe we don't read them as much. There is a group trying to translate the whole Mahayana canon, but they say it could take another 100 years. Most of us aren't willing to wait. But beyond all these practical considerations, another important factor is that our tendency in Zen is to focus on practice rather than study. It's not unusual to find even long-time Zen students who never read much of the sutras beyond what we chant in our services. And I'm sympathetic to this. A lot of us are much more comfortable reading than meditating. And so it's easy to get lost in the intellectual exercise of studying the sutras and find ourselves reading when maybe we would be better off sitting. But at the same time, I think reading Buddha's words can help us focus our practice. The sutras aren't intended as puzzles to be solved or deciphered. They are basic instructions Buddha gave to his students, his followers, to help them find the same awakening he found. Of course, he found awakening without the sutras, simply through committed practice, and some of us find it that way too. But for others, certainly including me, we seem to need a bit more guidance. We can get that guidance from a living teacher at a temple like this, but the sutras are another way. They are the guidance passed down from our original teacher. These days we hear a lot of talk about mindfulness. Mindfulness is taught in schools and companies, and there are countless books and articles with mindfulness in the title. And yet we know from these Pali Sutras that when Buddha first started teaching, he actually didn't dwell on mindfulness too much. He mentioned mindfulness in his very first sermon, but only briefly. I think if that first sermon was all you knew about Buddhism, you would not find mindfulness particularly central to his message. Buddha starts that first teaching by describing the middle way, which is basically the path of avoiding the two extremes that he had followed up until then. The key to life is not to run away from suffering, as he basically did as a prince for his first 29 years, or to wallow in suffering, as he did as an ascetic for the next 6, but to find a way to navigate in between. At an intellectual level, you might think of this as not avoiding suffering and not courting suffering, but accepting it and dealing with it. Then in this first talk, he got into a little more detail and explains that there are 8 parts to finding this middle way path. We need to cultivate right views, right intention, right speech, right action, right livelihood, right effort, right mindfulness, and right concentration. Buddha doesn't go into much detail beyond listing out these 8 things, and here at the outset, it isn't clear that he considers mindfulness any more important than any of the others. He then talks a bit more about suffering, explaining what we call the Four Noble Truths, that while suffering exists and is inevitable, there is a path to accept and ultimately overcome it. And here again, he explains that this way to overcome suffering is that same Eightfold Path. And that's it. That's the end of the first talk. After which, by the way, the ascetics who heard it all experienced awakening immediately. Mindfulness is mentioned twice, but only toward the end of his list of those 8 important parts of practice. And meditation, how we've been spending our morning, is not mentioned explicitly at all. But as Buddha continued to teach and expound on these initial ideas, mindfulness started to take on a more central position. Probably the best example of this is the Satipatthana Sutra, which can be translated roughly as the foundation of mindfulness, or perhaps better as the presence of mindfulness teaching. It's actually repeated twice in the Pali Canon with only slight variation, which maybe gives us some sense of the importance the early Buddhist monks and nuns placed on it. And it is here, in this Satipatthana Sutra, that Buddha explains that developing mindfulness is what he calls the direct path to realization. The rest of the Eightfold Path is important, but here he reveals that mindfulness is sort of the first among equals there. Mindfulness is the key. But why would mindfulness be any more important than right speech or right action? If you step outside the Buddhist context for a minute, this isn't obvious at all. Isn't mindfulness just a state of mind? Surely our actions cause more suffering than our thinking. We've all had the experience of causing suffering, either to ourselves or others, either intentionally or unintentionally, with our words and actions. But can we really cause suffering with our minds? And Buddha's answer is yes, we can. And we do, all the time. Because mindfulness is something of a linchpin for the rest of the Eightfold Path. There's really no way to cultivate right speech without paying attention to how we are speaking. There's really no way to cultivate right action without paying attention to what we're doing. Without mindfulness, we're stuck. It's like trying to follow Buddha's path in our sleep. Maybe this wasn't obvious to Buddha when he first started teaching. Or maybe it was so obvious that he felt he didn't even need to explain it. But this is why we focus so much on mindfulness in Buddhist practice today. Because mindfulness is really the key that unlocks the whole path. And mindfulness is hard. Our world is filled with distractions. But it's not just cell phones and screens that distract us. Mindfulness was hard even 2,500 years ago when Buddha lived. People struggled with distraction back then, just as we do now. And that wasn't just before cell phones and computers and television and radio. That was before paper. And still mindfulness and distraction was a real problem. So how do we develop this mindfulness? What hope is there to cut through all those distractions? This is where meditation comes in. And this is the main focus of this Satipatthana Sutra. Because this is where Buddha explains how to use meditation to cultivate mindfulness. Meditation is the way we practice mindfulness. And we mean practice here literally. It's the same way we might use finger exercises to practice piano. If you ever tried learning piano as a kid, or if you've watched another kid practice, you know that practicing piano is not the same as playing piano. When we practice, we might hit the same few notes over and over. We're developing muscle memory. We're training our minds to read the notes. But that's not the same thing as playing the piano. It's similar with driving. You might practice driving in an empty parking lot, or try to parallel park between two cones on a quiet street. But you're not really driving until you go out into practice. And so this is this relationship between the three things I started with: mindfulness, meditation, and Buddhism. Buddhism, what Buddhists call the Buddha Dharma, is Buddha's path to awakening. Mindfulness is the foundation of that path, the essential piece that allows us to follow it. And meditation is the practice to cultivate and develop that mindfulness. And so awakening is not about really what happens here in the Zendo on these cushions. Awakening is about how we take what happens here out into the world. The instructions Buddha gives in this sutra are quite detailed and probably too much to go into in a talk like this. And it isn't clear from his writing that you need to do them all anyways. A lot of later teachers felt just doing some of these exercises would be enough. But one thing I wanted to leave you with here is that about half of these exercises in mindfulness are about mindfulness of the body. It's common these days to hear people talk about how certain seemingly physical activities, like running or tennis or dancing or golf, are to a large extent mental. But the Buddha taught that the opposite is also true. We tend to think of meditation as a purely mental exercise, a way of quieting the mind. But it is also a physical activity. Meditation is, in a very real sense, something we do with our bodies. In Zen meditation, we often instruct beginners to start by contemplating their breath. And that's actually the first exercise Buddha recommends in this sutra, too. With each breath, we should be aware that we're breathing in. With each breath, we should be aware we're breathing out. We should be aware of long breaths and short breaths. But this is not just a mental awareness. It's a physical awareness, too. We should feel ourselves breathing. We should notice the way the breath enters our bodies and leaves our bodies. We should feel it against our mouth or nose. We should notice the way our chest rises and falls. We should feel our chest rise and fall. And you can try this right now, while we're sitting here together, taking a breath. And fully experiencing that breath. From there, Buddha encourages us to cultivate mindfulness of our entire body. When we sit, we should be aware of our whole body sitting. We should feel each point where our body touches the ground beneath us. We should feel our legs folded against each other. We should feel our arms resting on our lap. We should notice the air against our skin and feel this air, warm or cold, still or moving. Our awareness should include every part of our body right now. And this is where we can start to take our mindfulness practice off of the cushion. Buddha says that when we walk, we should be aware that we're walking. When we stand, we should be aware that we're standing. When we sit again or lie down, we should be aware of our bodies there too, our whole bodies. Walking, we should feel the way each part of our foot touches the earth, the way our weight shifts with every movement, the way our bodies respond to every step and every breath. How powerful are these mindfulness meditations? Buddha thought they were pretty powerful. In the Satipatthana Sutra, he starts by stating that anyone who practices these mindfulness meditation exercises for just 7 years will be guaranteed nirvana. That's pretty good. I mean, if you think about it, 7 years might sound long, but we spend 12 years in grade school, 4 just in high school. And what do we have to show for that? Many of us spend 4 or 5 more years or longer in college or university after that just to prepare for a job. Buddha is saying that in just 7 years of practice, we can do so much more. We can unlock the key to overcome all suffering. We can find nirvana. And then Buddha changes his mind. Maybe 6 years would be enough, or 5 or 4. And he gets all the way down to 1 year. And then he decides that even that is maybe more than we need. maybe just 7 months or 6 months. And he gets all the way down to 1 month and then half a month. And finally, he settles on 7 days. And that's it. That's as low as he'll go. But if we can fully practice mindfulness meditation for just 7 days, we are guaranteed awakening. That's a pretty good deal. But how is it possible? How can practicing these exercises for 7 days or even 7 years bring us closer to that awakening? Again, it's like the analogy with the piano. Over time, by practicing mindfulness this way in meditation, we inevitably start to bring that mindfulness into our daily lives. We may not be aware of every breath or every step throughout the day, but we stop sleepwalking through our days too. That awareness we cultivate here on these cushions starts to manifest itself out there. And that mindfulness that we bring with us, that makes the rest of Buddha's Eightfold Path possible out there too. We naturally start practicing right speech because we're mindful of the way our speech affects others. We start practicing right action because we're mindful of the consequences of our action. And so on. That mindfulness we cultivate is the key to the rest of the path. And so that's why we come to temples like Jikoji. This is where we can start to cultivate that mindfulness that we can then bring into our everyday lives. And it isn't easy, but it is possible. That's perhaps a final reason to read the sutras now and then, because they give us the record of one person who managed to walk this path. He was able to develop enough mindfulness to truly wake up. He realized enlightenment. And if he can do it, we can too. Thank you. I think we have time for some questions if anyone had anything they wanted to ask or say.
Could you talk a bit about the right and the right view and right speech and right all the things?
About what the word right means there?
Yeah, and what does it mean there?
Yeah. Well, it's an interesting formulation. And Buddha doesn't precisely define it. But I think what he's saying is that for each of these things, we have to find that middle way path. That path that doesn't cause suffering. And so I think, again, the only way to find that is to be aware of the consequences of our actions, what Buddha would call karma, the cause and effect in the world. So I think he would say that right speech is speech that does not cause undue suffering, that right action is action that does not cause undue suffering, and so forth. But we're left to work that out for ourselves. He doesn't give a detailed list, at least for lay people, of do's and don'ts. It's up to us to understand how each of these things manifests in the world and to find a way of living that helps liberate from suffering rather than causing it. Oh, sorry, I couldn't see you. Please.
So when I think about right speech and right action and of avoiding undue suffering, you know, of course that includes undue suffering to ourselves, you know. But I find that sometimes things cause suffering to ourselves that philosophically or spiritually or according to the Dharma shouldn't cause suffering. You know, like there's an illusion of suffering. Maybe that's not true, because like the suffering is a real experience that is arising. But I guess what I'm trying to say is sometimes there's something that seems like it shouldn't be painful because of, you know, things that we know to be true, but it still is painful. So I feel kind of caught between the reality of like, oh, this is the right thing to do, but I experience suffering, but I know that from a larger perspective, this isn't actually supposed to cause me suffering. So I guess the right thing to do sometimes does seem to cause suffering. So the idea of this middle way that causes, you know, minimal suffering sometimes seems very elusive.
Can you give an example of a struggle like that you've had?
Okay, so say I like had a, you know, I have an ex-boyfriend, right? And the loving thing for me to do that wouldn't cause undue suffering is to allow him to, you know, do what makes him happy and to not be in a relationship. That's right action. Like, I know that that's, and it seems like philosophically that should also be the path that causes the least undue suffering for me, but it's not. So it's hard to know what right action is to do without it being like, okay, this is right, and I just have to suffer, you know, to do the right thing.
Yeah. Well, so I think you bring up a couple things that are all very difficult. So one is that sometimes the thing that will reduce suffering in the long run seems to cause suffering in the short run. And then another, sort of related, is that sometimes the thing that seems like it reduces suffering for others brings some suffering on ourselves. And both of those are really difficult questions, and they come up all the time. Even in a much smaller context, sitting here this morning in the second period, one of my legs fell asleep and was painful. And so in that way, sitting brought about some suffering to me. On the other hand, I think that in the long run, sitting like that, you know, will help me overcome suffering. But it's hard to be sure. And we just have to try our best with sort of a calmness of mind to try to navigate these situations. And I think you find that all over in trying to find this middle way. If you think about the way the middle way was first described by Buddha, you know, one extreme was living a life of unbelievable luxury in a palace. The other extreme was things like not eating for weeks at a time and sleeping on a bed of nails. Well, there's a lot of room in between there. And that middle path is going to look different for different people. Some people might look at us sitting here, getting up somewhat early on a Sunday and spending a beautiful day largely indoors and think, that sounds like suffering. And that sounds like we're punishing ourselves. Other people would say, you know, the traditional Buddhist monks used to sit at dawn. We're starting at 10. That sounds like we're wallowing a little, taking it too easy. So it relates to the first question. I don't think there's a simple formula for finding that right action. And I do think these questions do quickly get very complicated. There's, you know, these very simple cases when you're walking down the street after it rains and you see a snail has come out on the sidewalk, you don't step on the snail. That's relatively straightforward. But as you say, there are so many cases where it's not clear what's going to reduce suffering the most and when to, in some ways, be a little tougher on ourselves and when not to. In this example you gave, it sounds like at some level you knew the right answer, the thing that would, in the long run, result in less suffering. It was just a hard path to take. And I think when those things happen, our practice is to take the harder path. But there are many cases where it's not clear. And hopefully our practice of cultivating this mindfulness and some awareness of cause and effect in the world, you know, help us make the best decisions we can. But in the end, these things are not easy.
I just like to know what the definition of suffering is, because I don't think you can be a person on earth and not have pain, you know. And I think for me, it's sort of like if I have a loved one, say a loved one dies or something, I'm gonna feel despair and grief, but I don't want to not have that feeling because I didn't want to love someone. But so then I get kind of like, well, what is suffering? What am I trying to be free of? Because you can have that range of feelings just by being human.
So the first noble truth that I mentioned is often translated as life is suffering. That, as you say, suffering is just part and parcel of being alive. And so when we talk about overcoming suffering, or even I think speaking loosely about extinguishing suffering, I don't think we're talking about making it go away exactly. I think we're talking about not letting it control us, being sort of free of its grasp. There's a Buddhist parable about the two arrows that suffering is kind of like being struck by two arrows. The first arrow is the physical pain that happens when something bad happens, or even the mental pain when we of loss and so forth. And then the second arrow is our sort of anger or resentment of that pain, of our desire not to have it, feeling of injustice or having been wronged. And Buddha taught that we can't avoid the first arrow. That is this inevitable part of life. We will all feel pain, we'll all suffer. But that second arrow is optional, that we don't have to suffer about the suffering. And so when we talk about that middle way, that path of right action and right speech and right view, it isn't about dodging those first arrows, which really was the life of luxury that Buddha tried. It's really about avoiding those second arrows, not giving them and not receiving them.
I think that works. You know, sometimes it's like if you do have a problem and you keep spinning it in your head, you keep
putting the suffering back on yourself because you keep playing the story over and over and over again. And that's where I find sometimes that mindfulness can help me. Just put it down. Just put it down. Just keep putting it down. And I don't keep hurting myself with my mental thoughts.
Yes. A teacher I had in a somewhat different context talked about, you know, when we're sitting, we have all these thoughts that come into our head, and they can be very distracting. And, you know, we can get sort of annoyed by all these thoughts. A song, something that we forgot to buy the last time we were at the store, all kinds of things. And she used to say that, you know, there's nothing wrong, actually, with having these thoughts. But you don't have to invite them to sit down for tea. You can just kind of let them come and then let them go. And just not be bothered by them. And I think to some extent that's true of suffering as well. It's of course much harder when something terrible has happened. But we can accept the suffering when it comes, but not sort of indulge in it, as you say, put it down, and just let it be there.
What role does the self play in the exercise of mindfulness?
I don't know that it plays a role exactly. I think part of the exercise that Buddha recommends around this mindfulness of the body is that you're mindful not just sort of the internal body, but the external, everything that's going around. As I mentioned, the ground beneath maybe your knees, the air against your face. And you start to realize that there is not this hard boundary. That it is just sort of this, the Zen expression is a bag of skin that's here with air coming and going, coming from me to you, to everyone here. And as we wake up to that reality, I think there's a sort of letting go of the self. That it's no more central or real than anything else. It's just another thought that can come and go, and that we can put down.
Figuring out how to ask this question. But there's one thing that I work with in practice where it feels like sometimes there are different sets of instructions for different times. And this comes with feeling emotions, and like what Holly was talking about reminded me of this, like feelings of grief and things like that. My experience is that they're, especially grief, is not predictable, and it moves very unpredictably. And what I see with people around me and myself, my experience of it, or you know, other emotions that are challenging like that, there's a lot of judgment. There's a lot of, like, we shame ourselves for feeling it. And maybe that's the extra stuff. Maybe those are the extra arrows. But I've also been told to just trust it as it is and just let it be and let it move. And we also talk about emotions as kleshas. And I'd love to, in my question somehow, to have it address how there's a wisdom to feeling, but also confusion to feeling, perhaps, or if maybe that is a mistaken idea, or How is that viewed? Or how would you possibly address that?
So I think in the end, there's only one instruction, really, which is to wake up, pay attention. And what you're paying attention to is reality, is the world as it is. And that reality certainly includes suffering and grief. You know, the story is that Buddha left the palace because for the first time he encountered sickness, old age, and death, the suffering that none of us can escape. And so I think you're right that, you know, we will have times of sadness and pain, and that we have to wake up and pay attention to those too. And we'll have times of joy and happiness and pleasure. And again, there's a temptation to sort of wallow in it and indulge in it. But Buddha teaches that those are just as temporary, those are just as fleeting. And so we should be aware and pay attention to those, but understand that those are going to pass as well. There is nothing permanent here. And so again, it's not about running away from suffering or grief or unhappiness, or chasing after joy and pleasure, but experiencing each thing as it is. And becoming aware of the world as it is, and gradually starting to accept that this is the world we're in, and through that acceptance, to somehow loosen that grip that these emotions so often have on us.
I just have an observation. I don't know if this is true for anybody else, but when I was young, my parents used to send me to corner and stare at the wall to wonder time out.
Yeah.
But we just spent the last 2 hours, and it's so what then was considered suffering is now.
Yeah. It's true. And that's why I say I think this middle way, it does look different to different people. And some people would look at how we are spending our time here and say that we're beating ourselves up, we're giving ourselves time out. I think the middle way path is a broad path. There's room for lots of different ways to navigate. And I find, and I hope you find, that by sort of taking this time out, we start to cultivate this mindfulness and awareness that then we can bring with us when we allow ourselves to go out and play.
You took the example of the piano, that practicing on the piano is different from playing it. And sometimes we just experiment with the keys and like just figure out how, and we'll move from one key to another. And so I was just curious that from what you talked about, like you quoted the Buddha, that how he said that when you walk, feel how the foot touches on the ground and all of those things. So when we meditate, we are practicing in a sense, but then when we go out and when we are dealing with our daily lives, we're driving a car, cooking a meal, we're taking a shower, we're studying, and all of those things. So I'm just curious if there's other ways to exercise rather than just being aware that, okay, I'm doing this right now, and this is how I'm doing it right now. But are there other exercises for bringing mindfulness to all of those daily activities?
I think there are many. And I think all of us just have to try different things, see what works for us. So for example, some people find eating in silence, at least some of their meals, is a way of bringing some mindfulness to their eating, and similarly to take silent walks. For other people, it's really trying to focus on one thing at a time. So when you're reading, to just read, not have, you know, the radio or something else on. When you're doing the dishes, just do the dishes without something else going on. You know, there are many exercises you can do throughout the day. Pausing to focus on your breath, even just for 2 or 3 breaths at different points during the day. I really think anything that just kind of brings you back to the world as it is. When I was younger, I tried an exercise, I don't even remember where I got it, where I tried to notice the color of eyes of everybody I met. And it was just, like I said, a little trick, a little exercise to force me to just pay a little bit more attention to each person that I was meeting during the day. Anything that just kind of brings you back and tries to make you aware, makes you wake up a little more, I think can be helpful. That bell was the cook telling us, I think, that it's time for lunch. So thanks all of you for coming. I very much enjoyed speaking with you.
May our intentions equally extend to every being and place with the true merit of Buddha's way. Beings are numberless. I vow to save them. Delusions are inexhaustible. I vow to end them. Dharma gates are boundless. I vow to enter them. Buddha's way is unsurpassable.
Thank you for listening to this podcast offered by Jokoji Zen Center. Our Dharma talks are offered free of charge, and this is made possible by the donations we receive. Your support helps us to continue to offer the Dharma. For more information about Jokoji, please visit us on the web at jokoji.org.